You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 5th of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
No stars for five-star in Italian local elections. Georgia's former president returns, maybe staying longer than he planned. And Russia's attempt to do space odyssey for real. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Daniela Peled and Enrico Franceschini will discuss all the day's big stories. We'll hear from Hong Kong, where Chief Executive Carrie Lam may or may not be about to make a big announcement. And our On This Day series considers the events of October 5th, 1910 in Portugal. Stay tuned. All that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Daniela Peled, Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Enrico Franceschini, London correspondent for La Repubblica. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Are either of you massive fans of early 20th century Portuguese history?
Funny you should mention that.
No, that's good. We have an exciting show for you then. Do stick around for the last item. It's going to be big.
Good.
But first, we will start with voters in local elections in Italy, who appear to be the latest to have absorbed the lesson that if one elects clowns, one gets a circus. The Five Star Movement, founded, of course, by a literal comedian amid the populist uproar of recent times, has sustained a bit of a kicking and seems poised to lose the city halls of Rome and Turin, among others. Overall, it seems a pretty solid set of results for relatively sensible centre-left parties, although there have been depressingly decent numbers for the Brothers of Italy, who appear to be attracting the unsavoury far-right crank vote away from the League. Enrico, we will come to the far-right presently, but let's start with the far-left, i.e., well, if that's how you can characterise Five Star, hard to tell which may have been the problem. Is this possibly the beginning of the end for them?
Well, it could be, because the pandemic has taught the Italians that, pragmatism and reason are important factors in choosing your leaders. Also, we have had the good experience for the past few months of having a very good prime minister, former governor of the Central Bank of Europe, Mario Draghi, was tried to instill some rationality in our politics, successfully, it seems, more than could be expected. And so Italians did not vote for the Five Stars movement as they did in the past. They got less votes than since the beginning of their history in politics. It could be the beginning of the end. It could be that they now will be forced into an alliance with the Democratic Party, the biggest party of the center-left, but as a minority party. We still have to remember in the current parliament, they are still the largest party, unbelievable as it might sound. Inside the Five Star, there are two currents, one that fights for, more reason, alliance with the left, getting all the progressive forces together, another one who wants to go back to the crazy politics of the founder, the comedian, Beppe Grillo, being against everything, everybody, making strange proposals. But maybe Italy, as other countries in Europe, is going through a saner, healthier period of politics.
Well, it would be nice to think so. Daniela, the UK, obviously an exception to the rule, but is there a possibility that voters are now starting to realise that there might be something to be said for electing people to govern them who do in fact have some idea what they're doing?
Well, I think this reflects the usual trajectory of these kinds of populist parties, but not just populist parties, but parties that attempt to be post-ideological. So you have the charismatic leader and this idea that they're against everything and against the political elite, especially, and the old way of doing things. And then when they come into power and then they become part of the political elite, they lose their reason for being, and the exciting, dynamic young bucks of politics become the dull, middle-aged managers of politics, which is basically what politics is supposed to be about, you know, dull management. And so the cycle starts again, and especially in the case of, from what I understand about Five Star, is that they don't have a firm ideological base at all. So if in the absence of that, that plus government, plus compromise with responsible political actors, kind of destroys your point of existing in the first place.
Enrico, if we look at the specific cases of Rome and Turin, which were, you know, two big results for Five Star to have the mayors of such important cities, was it that classic case of somebody arriving in office, making sort of grand promises and bold slogans and dramatic speeches and saying that all these problems are actually really simple and straightforward and everything can be easily fixed, who then gets entrusted with a position of responsibility and discovers that governing is actually really difficult and boring?
Yes, exactly. Particularly in Rome, the administration of the Five Stars movement was terrible. It was one of the worst in the history of Rome, perhaps. So the people of Rome rejected them. Turin also was not very good. And interesting enough, one of their candidates who did quite well or better than others was one who belongs to the moderate faction of the Five Stars movement and that preaches, return to the traditional politics, not to the craziness that we've seen right now. We also have to remember that they in the current parliament, they were allied in the first part of in the first two couple of years with the far right, with the Lega, with the League, and with the rightist forces. Then they switched to the Democratic Party. That didn't help also with their supporters, because as Daniela said, it's not clear then where they stand.
Daniela, do we have to be a bit careful, though, about thinking too wishfully about populist bubbles getting burst and so forth? There was an amount of chatter on those lines last week following the German elections as well, although German elections almost always end up electing reasonably sensible people, because that's what the Germans, at least since World War II, have generally done. But is there a concern that one section of the electorate will just keep pursuing crankier and crankier options rather than sort of realizing, we voted for some, you know, grandstanders and dingbats and it didn't go terribly well? So instead of retreating from that, they just go even further out there.
I think there's always going to be a contingent of the public who are going to vote for those kinds of outliers. The question is how much power do they have in a political system, and how much power that party has. One of the issues, again, with these kinds of populist movements, they attract both the far right and the far left. You know, similarly, the anti-vaccine movement, for instance, or other conspiracy theorists attract people from both sides of the political spectrum. Because if you're everything to all people, it's very easy to impose your own views on this kind of blank slate. And also, if you're basically predicated on being against the status quo, that again makes you a very convenient meeting point for people united perhaps by not very much, apart from the fact they think the status quo is a bit bogus.
Enrico, which does introduce us to the concept of the Brothers of Italy. The League for a long time attracted quite a lot of notice outside Italy as being a somewhat unpleasant, unsavoury, far-right parcel of xenophobes. The Brothers of Italy have got them well and truly covered on that front, haven't they? How far out there are these people?
Quite far, because many of them are no vaxxers. Some of them are openly nostalgic about fascism and not ashamed of saying good things about the era when Mussolini was in power in Italy. So they are quite rightist, and and quite an embarrassment they should be for what a traditional conservative moderate rightist movement has been in Italy in the past, at the time of the Christian Democrats in what we call the First Republic, before everything changed. It must be said that by themselves it's going to be difficult for them to ever win government. They have to go into an alliance with the former, what is left of the Silvio Berlusconi's party, and with the League. And inside this movement, too, there have been some changes. The people who performed better at the polls this time were the ones who were, you know, advocating conservative ideas, but not being necessarily against vaccines for COVID, or not being openly fascist. So it's a moment of truth for Italian politics, perhaps, in which you have to choose if to, you know, push the extremism and the populism, or try to win more votes by the broad center with a more moderate and rational approach.
Just a final quick thought on this, Enrico. There's an obvious difference there between Italy and Germany, in that while Italy does have a party of somewhat unpleasant xenophobic cranks, Alternative for Deutschland, even they would go nowhere near language of that sort of outright nostalgia for the 1940s. Why is that still a live thing in Italy? Why is it not instantly career-ending?
Well, it's a good point. I think Germany went through, you know, a more open time of looking what Nazism meant for them. Italy, you know, they in the middle of the war, they changed sides, and fascism by many is being considered a more lenient form of extremism, something of a joke, or like if we didn't really send the Jews to the chambers, while in fact they did, and so in the popular memory has been not blamed as much as Nazism in Germany.
Okay, well, let's move along somewhat, but stick with the subject of the perils of entrusting officers of state to compulsive grandstanders. Georgia has welcomed back former President Mikhail Saakashvili, although by welcomed, we mean arrested. Saakashvili pitched up on Saturday after some 8 years in substantially unlamented exile, hoping to lead his United National Movement party to victory in local elections being held around the country. Instead, he's in the Huskau in Rustavi, and the United National Movement got hosed. Daniela, it's always an open question where Mikhail Saakashvili is concerned, and I apologise for putting it to you, but there's probably no wrong answers, in fairness. What does he appear to have thought he was doing?
This is a serious political development. Nonetheless, as an outside observer, it's just delicious political theatre. We all saw the images of him being led away in handcuffs, grinning delightedly.
Almost like it's exactly what he wanted.
Exactly. He faces a 6 years in prison. I'm talking to colleagues about this, and there seems to be, you know, some theories. He's just announced, also taking the opportunity to announce a new romance with a 30-year-old Ukrainian politician.
I missed that in my research.
Yep. So that's one thing. I mean, well, I was surprised by his return, because he's threatened to do this half a dozen times before, and he never does. Look, this feeds wonderfully into his own narrative of being politically heroic and a brave patriot, etc., etc. He's not particularly popular necessarily with the party that he founded, and many people were saying before his return, because he posted a picture of his plane ticket on Facebook, you know, very typical style, saying that people that might have voted for the UNM might not, if they think that it means getting him back again. But also, Georgian Dream has not covered themselves with glory.
Indeed not.
No, making it clear that, what do they say, if he doesn't behave, we'll find some other things to charge him with. I mean, yay for democracy there.
Well, I mean, he is in enough trouble as it is. And Enrico, I guess this was the bind he knew very well that he was placing Georgian authorities in. On the one hand, you can see how they might have thought that the sensible tack would just be, you know, ignore him. You know, if he wants to come back, fine, whatever, see if we care. But they can't really do that, given that he has an actual conviction for abuse of office. And as Daniela said, he's on the hook for 6 years. They can't wave that off.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Saakashvili was a president for about 10 years. He was considered a Westerner at the beginning.
He was quite the thing at the time.
Very popular. Then he took some autocratic positions. And now everything seems, a madhouse. The temptation to say the Georgie is always seems a madhouse. But the truth is, I've been there several times when I lived in Moscow. Georgia is a wonderful country with wonderful cuisine, wonderful people. In the Soviet Union, when people told jokes, the best jokes were told by the Georgians. They are figures, they are larger than life, really. And Saakashvili and his opponents now are not the most extreme politicians we've seen there. I mean, the first president after the fall of the Soviet Union was a guy called Gamsa Kurdia. I went to interview him once in his office in Tbilisi, and I'm not even making this up, in this huge room. I saw the same scene that Ernest Hemingway said that he not when he went to interview Mussolini. He was reading a book, trying to show very much that he was reading it, but the book was upside down.
you can kind of see, given that context, how Saakashvili was seen at the time as an improvement. But again, Daniela, and I apologize for asking you to inhabit the interior workings of Mikhail Saakashvili. What happened to him? Because there was this time when he was seen as, you know, the future of Central Europe. He was this young, Western educated, charming, dashing, English speaking, Western facing Democrat who was going to fix everything. And I don't feel like his CV since then has been what he would have predicted or wanted himself.
No, definitely not. But I think perhaps expectations were a bit too high as well, and the 2008 war didn't help. It certainly didn't help him domestically. And as much as Georgia was moving towards this very Western orientated and flourishing democracy, there's been so much black backsliding in recent years, and the country has been in absolute chaos since the parliamentary elections in October 2020. Because the opposition did not recognise the results and have been boycotting parliament, and there's increasing incursions on freedom of speech and harassment of the media and domination of the political scene by people connected to oligarchs. And so the trajectory of Georgia that seemed so promising, maybe when Saakashvili was in power, is much, much more troubling now.
Enrico, just a final thought on Mikhail Saakashvili. He is now claiming to be a political prisoner and also claiming to be on hunger strike. Is it clear, as far as we can tell, that anybody in Georgia much still cares what he thinks or does? Or is he about to find himself being the key figure in that joke about what you call a follower with no leaders, answer a bloke going for a walk?
Well, there have been demonstrations in front of his of the place where he is in prison.
Not terrifically big ones.
Not big ones, a few hundreds people, is true. And the other thing is that the West also has not been very much, you know, ready to run to defend him as he would have done, as he did years ago. So he seems to have put himself in a very troubling position. Yeah, not clear what he wanted.
Enrico and Daniela, thank you both for the moment. Now to Hong Kong, where tomorrow people will be tuning in to watch Chief Executive Carrie Lam's annual policy address to see if she'll be announcing whether or not she's running for office again in 2022. Carrie Lam's time as Chief Executive has been marked by two of Hong Kong's biggest crises, but recent clampdowns on political opposition may give her the space she needs to secure a second term. Monocle's Naomi Zhu Elegant sent us this dispatch from Hong Kong.
Hong Kong's Chief Executive Carrie Lam will deliver her annual policy address tomorrow. It is Lam's last big public speech before her job is up for grabs in the chief executive election in March next year. She's expected to discuss Hong Kong's housing supply shortage, ongoing travel restrictions, and a potential government bureau restructuring, but most people will be tuning in to see if she drops hints about whether she'll run for a second term. Depending on her decision, tomorrow's policy address could be a look ahead to the next 5 years or a closing valedictory on her time in office. While locals debate and make bets around the water cooler, it may come as a surprise for people outside of Hong Kong that Lam even has a chance of running again. After a relatively quiet start to her first term as chief executive, the career civil servant and serial high achiever went on to preside over two of the region's biggest crises since the handover, the 2019 protests and the pandemic. While her handling of the latter may well be remembered for prioritizing lives over livelihoods, her legacy will be forever defined by her role in setting off the protests.
The concerns over the past few months have been caused by deficiencies in the work of the SAR government over the amendment exercise. I personally have to shoulder much of the responsibility. For this, I offer my most sincere apology to all people of Hong Kong.
In 2019, Lam pushed for an extradition law that could have resulted in defendants being sent to mainland China to stand trial. Public opposition to that law sparked Hong Kong's longest-running protest movement. One march brought as many as 2 million people out onto the streets, a remarkable feat in a city of only 7.5 million. Lam's face plastered anti-government protest signs and posters for months. At the time, she reportedly told guests at a private dinner that she wanted to resign. But Beijing kept her in place, and Lam regained her composure and control of the city with the help of a sweeping national security law in 2020. Since then, the most vocal opposition voices have either left town or been locked up, leaving behind a pliant legislature and the prospect of a 5-year term without any filibustering. There's plenty of smart money on Lam running again as she tries to turn around her tarnished legacy. She could even end up achieving something that none of her three predecessors managed, 2 full terms as chief executive. That doesn't mean she'll run unopposed. Several pro-Beijing candidates are purportedly considering a run. There's even talk of Lam's predecessor, CY Leung, staging an unlikely comeback.
Okay, I want to answer another question, which is, I want to say I wouldn't resign.
Beijing will want to give the appearance of a choice. However, some things in Hong Kong have not changed. Despite all the electoral tinkering and calls for universal suffrage, the next chief executive will still be selected by a small group of people, and regular citizens will have no say in the matter. If Lam runs again, it will be with the approval of the central government. While the makeup of this committee has been overhauled, the majority of voting members will continue to be guided in their decision by Beijing, just as they always have been.
Thank you, Naomi. You are listening to The Monocle Daily. I'll be back with more from our panel right after this.
Allianz is proud to partner The Monocle Daily on Monocle 24. Since 1890, Allianz has stood side by side with people as they overcame the impossible. Allianz has always been an innovator. Allianz secures people's future, giving them confidence in tomorrow. Allianz knows how important it is to have a fair partner at your side, to provide solid and sustainable solutions. Allianz strives to do it right, with passion, every day. Allianz. Confidence in tomorrow.
Welcome back to The Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests Daniela Peled and Enrico Franceschini. There have, of course, been any number of films set in space, some of which are not dreadful. However, there is now going to be one made in space, apparently. Russian director Klim Shchepenko and Russian actor Yulia Perasild have arrived at the International Space Station to begin work on a film believed to have the working title The Challenge. It seems a deliberate attempt to forestall a Hollywood project in development, which apparently involves Tom Cruise, NASA, and Elon Musk's SpaceX. Daniela, obviously we have to get behind any amount of launching actors into space, although I believe there are plans to bring them back. But nonetheless, are you excited to see what actually results here?
Well, it's a bit of an improvement from the Star Wars of my childhood, where we all expected the Russians and the Americans to be blowing each other up, and indeed the entire world at any point. The thing is, what did you call it? It was called the adventure, the challenge?
The challenge.
Yeah, that could be anything, really, couldn't it? It could be something really quite unsavoury.
There is a plot. I think it's something to do with a rescue, a surgery that needs doing or something. It will doubtless be very suspenseful.
Yeah, okay, and I'm sure it will be super politically correct with a really strong female lead as well, right?
Well, there literally is a female lead, unless Yulia Perisild is operating under some sort of cover I cannot begin to fathom. I think it's not like they've got a big cast up there. I think they're literally using some of the other inhabitants of the ISS as extras, because clearly they've got nothing else to do.
Fair. So Russia sees Elon Musk going for it and says, hold my pint, we're going to make a film.
Yeah, basically that. Enrico, this is not really a throwback to the classic days of the early space race, is it? This does all seem somewhat trivial and footling by comparison.
Yes, but, I detected in Daniela's a slight hint of anti-Russian sentiments, but I must say, in defense of the country where I spent so much time, where my son was born, that, Russia were the first, they're the first dog, they were the first flight, the first dog in space, the first man and the first woman. Mm-hmm. Now they're going to have the first movie shot in space. So, I mean, why they should not try to be first? They didn't beat the Americans in the race to the moon, must be said.
That is true.
So they're trying to catch back something. And why not? I mean...
But, Daniel, leaving aside you coming on this program and insulting the land of Enrico's son's birth, is there actually any imaginable artistic reason for this? Because the thing is, not that I've spent a great deal of time in space stations, indeed I'll level with you, none, but they strike me as quite difficult, not hospitable environments for filming or indeed doing terribly much of anything in. And I just worry that filming for real on a space station after the sort of rich and lurid lineage of science fiction movies we already have, it's just going to look kind of prosaic and rubbish, isn't it?
Well, we kind of know what it's going to look like without seeing it, because we have this very vivid image in our minds of what...
My point being the Death Star it is not going to be.
Quite. Well, not to do down Russia's very long and respectable history of artistic and cultural achievement, but this, again... This is
you're already on the list, Daniela.
Fair enough. At least I have a nice long rest. But this is another example of Russia trying to use soft power, which it doesn't really have necessarily that much of these days. It's a bit further on from hosting some sort of football championships or sporting events, but being the first guys to make a film in space could detract perhaps from other reputational issues that Russia has down here on Earth.
Enrico, do you think there is a soft power triumph here, though? I mean, again, this is not really like those early soft power triumphs you mentioned, putting Sputnik into space, putting Laika into space, Yuri Gagarin, Valentina Tereshkova. Is anybody really going to care about this?
It's a good question. Perhaps not. The thing is that, space has been so exciting for all the first part of the conquest with NASA and everything, it is difficult to top the real achievements there. I mean, now we know China wants to go to the moon. That's going to be a bigger thing than making a movie in the stars, among the stars. But let's see what happens. Russia has a great tradition of making great movies. Let's see how they do this.
Do either of you, just finally, Daniela first, have a particular favourite space movie, other obviously than Airplane 2?
Spaceballs?
Spaceballs, equally highbrow choice. Good, well done. Enrico?
I go with the classics. Space Odyssey is my favourite.
Okay, well... Moving along finally for our panel, the next edition of the Oxford English Dictionary will be swelled by 26 words of Korean origin. Some of these, doubtless overdue, pertain to Korean food, which sensible people everywhere have been eating for ages, bulgogi, kimbap, galbi et al. But other editions reflect the surging influence of Korean, well, South Korean, popular culture. While K-pop cracked the OED as long ago as 2016, it is now joined by K-drama, which is self-explanatory, and mukbang, which is not. That's the live streaming of someone eating, which is a thing for some reason. These have brought older Korean terms into the English canon in their wake, among them the Korean costume hanbok. First of all, do we have any big mukbang fans here at the table? People who like to spend an evening tuning into live streams of other people eating, which is, as I said, a thing for some reason?
Well, I'm wondering, maybe this could be my next career move, actually, as a performer.
I can vouch that you do make excellent, if occasionally eccentrically themed, cakes.
I
have seen entire Instagram influencer careers constructed from flimsier pretexts. I fear we are deviating from the point somewhat. Enrico, which of these new Korean phrases are you most looking forward to dropping into everyday conversation?
Among the words that have been chosen? I don't know. Bento? Perhaps.
I think it's closer to Japanese than Korean, and that's two major diplomatic incidents in one program now.
My Korean is not up to date, I must confess.
But this is, I think, quite a heartening / terrifying illustration of how the English language, much as the English people at one point did, just have a kind of knack for just absorbing everything, whether or not the everything actually wanted it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very delighted by this. If you look at all of our, many of our most fun words come from other languages, and not that I want to create another diplomatic incident, but I will.
The ship has sailed.
I will. But it's nice to know that we have nothing like the sort of perhaps apocryphal French commission for keeping
words out. No, it's a real
words
thing.
Out.
They've all got special outfits.
Yeah. Great. Well, we don't have that. We have the opposite. We have the opposite, which I make one of the reasons I am proud to drink a cup of tea and sing God Save the Queen.
Well, on that note of inclusion, I did want to ask you each, because both of you do speak languages other than English, whether there are words still as yet unplucked from them by the English language that you think should be incorporated. I mean, to get the ball rolling, I will suggest one from the other language I speak, i.e. Australian. And there have been a few which have made it into the English language. The two I'm a big fan of, one is an arcane Australian slang for the police, which says a lot about how law enforcement used to work in Australia 100 or so years ago, which was referring to the police as the wallopers, which I would like to see making more of a general comeback. And I do like the specifically modern use of the word bonzer, B-O-N-Z-E-R, which traditionally was an expression of satisfaction, described things as bonzer, but which more recently I have heard deployed in a more deadpan fashion when everything's just gone horribly, horribly wrong. And you just sort of say bonzer as you watch the catastrophe unfolding around you. I think that's a good one. You've had all that time to think now, Enrico.
I'm at a loss because so many Italian words are already in the English language. You know, ciao, people say, pizza, everybody, spaghetti, macaroni, amore, who doesn't know what amore means. So I don't know.
See, if I'd gone through that lot, it would have been another diplomatic incident.
I will go with the main food of my hometown that people should learn. Maybe you know that already. Tortellini. You didn't know tortellini is a kind of small macaroni shaped, as we say in Bologna, my hometown, as the belly button of the goddess Venus.
Wow.
Okay, I had heard of tortellini, but not that definition of it. So I have learned something this evening. Daniela?
Well, I also speak Hebrew, but that's a very lyrical and poetic language. I think much more fun would be to choose a word from Yiddish, which many already
indeed so
in the English language, you know, schmuck, chutzpah, etc., etc. But there's a little used word which I think is delightful. It's you roll it around your mouth. It's oibachochum. Right? How great is that to say? Oibachochum.
It's also very easy to say. Right?
Ah, it's delightful. It means. And this is not something that my mother used to call me growing up. It means too clever for your own good.
Daniela Peled and Enrico Franceschini, thank you both for joining us on The Daily. Finally on today's show, it is time for the latest instalment of our irregular historical series on this day, irregular in more ways than one. Clue as to the general premise of the segment is in the name, and today we mark the 111th anniversary of the revolution which kind of made Portugal what it is. Everybody's favourite Portuguese revolution is, of course, the Carnation Revolution of 1974. In fairness, there's nothing not to like. The Carnation Revolution overthrew a miserable tyranny, hastened the end of Portugal's wars in its colonies in Africa, set the country on the path to democracy, accomplished all that with barely a shot fired, and in a delightfully idiosyncratic touch, the coup plotters gave the go order to their co-conspirators by broadcasting on local radio that year's Portuguese entry in the Eurovision Song Contest, the fittingly titled E Depois do Adiós by Paulo de Carvalho. However, the real hipster's choice among aficionados of Portuguese revolutions is the one that occurred on this day in 1910. Portugal's October Revolution has been perhaps occluded in the popular memory by another October Revolution which occurred in Russia 7 years later. Which is a shame. Portugal's is very nearly its equal in terms of drama, intrigue, tragedy, ambition, and disappointment. Revolutions, for all that they may be identified with a particular date, are rarely sudden or spontaneous. Momentum towards the climactic events of October 5th, 1910, had been gathering a while. Abroad, Portugal's empire was unravelling. At home, the economy was tanking. The country had declared itself bankrupt in 1892 and 1902. In February 1908, a pair of Republican militants had shot dead King Carlos I and his heir, Prince Luís Filipe, as the royal carriage rolled through Lisbon. The king's second son, 18-year-old Manuel, was wounded but survived to inherit a crown that sat extremely uneasily. King Manuel II sought to be a more traditionally aloof constitutional monarch than his somewhat meddlesome father, but this did little to alleviate Portugal's woes or calm its turbulent politics. Seven governments came and went in 2 years. Emboldened by the chaos, the Republicans acted. The revolt was anticipated by authorities, but the rebels had organised themselves well. Such fighting as there was lasted barely a day. The United States representative in Portugal at the time, former governor of California Henry T. Gage, reported to the State Department that the revolution was perfectly planned and carried to success in every detail with great celerity. Well played on the casual use of a 50-cent word like celerity in such uncertain circumstances. King Manuel, though far from old, was sufficiently wise to take the hint. He lit out for Gibraltar aboard the royal yacht Amelia and spent the rest of his life in London, devoting himself substantially to the study of medieval Portuguese literature. The stained glass windows he donated to St. James Church in Twickenham are still there. The country he fled, now led by the playwright and poet Teófilo Braga, declared itself a republic. This proved, as so often, easier said than done. In the 16 years of what is recalled by history as the first Portuguese Republic, there were 8 presidents, 38 prime ministers, something like that anyway, any number of disturbances, riots and uproars, including a brief civil war in 1919. In 1926, Portugal's army seized power, beginning the decades of military rule which would be ended by 1974's Eurovision soundtracked uprising. The first Portuguese Republic, inaugurated on this day in 1910, eventually collapsed in shambles and failure, but may just have been ahead of its time. It established a tradition of democracy robust enough to outlast the dictatorship which followed it, and it gave Portugal the flag it still flies and the anthem it still sings. And that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to our panellists today, Daniela Pellet and Enrico Franceschini. Our thanks also to Naomi Zhu Elegant in our Hong Kong bureau. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.